From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing on.
ISIS is on the advance, and Rand Paul says that's Republican hawks' fault. Hello and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, correspondent for The Upshot at The New York Times, coming to you today from Harvard University. On the left, Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at truthdig.com, is at KCRW in Santa Monica. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and our special guest is Michael Kay, foreign correspondent and former pilot in the British Royal Air Force. Welcome to all of you. ISIS has been making significant gains this month in Syria and Iraq, taking the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra and overrunning Ramadi, the capital of Anbar province in Iraq, which is less than 100 miles from Baghdad. ISIS took Ramadi despite being vastly outnumbered by Iraqi troops who simply did not fight to retain the city. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter said this about the fall of Ramadi.
We obviously can't give them the will to fight. But if we give them training, we give them equipment, and give them support, and give them some time, I hope they will develop the will to fight, because only if they fight can ISIL remain defeated.
I hope they will gain the will to fight. Bob, that's not very reassuring, is it?
Well, first of all, how did we lose the touch? After all, when we attracted Muslim Sunni fanatics to Afghanistan to take on the Soviets, we thought we could instill the will to fight, and they did a pretty good job of causing a lot of mayhem, and to the satisfaction of two different American presidents, Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. And suddenly we have lost, what, the touch? We're not paying enough. We're not excitable enough, I think, is one issue. The other is, we clearly have made war against the leaders in the Mideast, the dictators, if you like, who were very effective in controlling Sunni fanaticism. It was Saddam Hussein, it was Gaddafi, and now Assad in Syria. And so we're not clear about what our mission is. And the only way we're going to defeat ISIS is by making an alliance with the other Muslims, the Shiite, led basically by Iran, who we also are at war with. So what the real problem is not the will to fight. It's a totally contradictory, irrational policy.
Rich, what do you make of this situation? That, you know, I mean, you even hear Ashton Carter in that clip saying, you know, we need to do things so ISIS will remain defeated. It doesn't make a lot of sense to say that ISIS is defeated right now. And broadly, the Obama administration's, you know, positive messaging about ISIS being on the defensive, it's starting to sound like the Bush administration in 05, 06, insisting that the situation in Iraq was fine when it wasn't.
Yeah, it's a real disconnection from reality. We were supposed to be preparing to take back Mosul, and now we've lost Ramadi, another major city, and are going to have a struggle to take it back. And I just really object to the notion that Bashar al-Assad, for instance, is doing a great job controlling ISIS when he's lost huge swaths of his country to ISIS and gave it really the staging ground to sweep into the vacuum left in Iraq when we pulled out entirely. So this is it's a big problem. It's a hideously complex problem with no easy solution, but at least the beginning of wisdom is acknowledging what's really happening on the ground.
Mikey, where is there to go from here? Sort of, it's as Secretary Carter describes, and the Iraqis, the Shiite Iraqi government will not fight to retain these Sunni areas. Are there options besides basically letting ISIS run rampant over these parts of Syria and Iraq and reinvading? Senator Lindsey Graham is saying we should put 10,000 troops on the ground in Iraq. Are those our only two options here?
No, Josh, I don't think they are. I think America has to eat a little bit of humble pie, and we need to go back to core principles. If you go back to 2007, there were 180,000 coalition troops in Iraq who managed to tame the insurgency. They never managed to beat the insurgency. They managed to tame it. And there's a fundamental misunderstanding about contemporary warfare at the moment, Josh, which is it's asymmetric. ISIS and Al-Qaeda do not play by any rules. They do not adhere to the Geneva Convention, the Rome Statute, the International Criminal Court. They effectively do what they want. And the reason why they've been so effective in Ramadi is because instead of using one or two VBIEDs, vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices of the suicide nature, they went in there with six to eight and they hit the place hard. Now, what we've got to do is we've got to understand that we have to play by the rules. And I think 180,000 troops in Iraq in 2007 tell us that it doesn't matter how much air power you throw at this. 7.8 million tons of bombs were dropped on Vietnam. That's more than Europe and Japan combined in World War II. And how did the outcome in Vietnam look? It wasn't great. And it doesn't matter how much ground forces you throw at this. If you can't play on a level playing field, it's going to be difficult. So what's the answer? To me, the answer is you have to have a real hard question and look at yourself about the conversation of Iran. There are three key players in Iraq. There's a Peshmerga, there's a populist mobilization forces, which are the Shia, and then there's the government of Iraq forces. GOI, the government of Iraq forces, have capitulated. Now, this notion of going in and training government forces over a period of five years to fight an insurgency such as ISIS is nonsense. You can't do it. We weren't able to do it with 180,000 troops with decades of experience. Why should we expect the GOI forces to be able to do that? So the way around it is that you've got to acknowledge, this is the question we've got to ask you, Josh, and I'll get to the point. The US needs to ask itself, through a baddie at the government, you've got the Peshmerga, the populist mobilization forces, and you've got GOI forces. Can we do this with the Peshmerga and the GOI forces without the populist mobilization forces, which are Iranian-backed? Can we fight them in Iraq without the populist mobilization forces? And if the answer is yes, then we progress down one route. But there will be another question that you have to ask yourself, which is how do you prevent the populist mobilization forces from getting involved? If the answer is no, we can't, and we need to utilize the populist mobilization forces, then there needs to be a conversation at the political level to work out a power-sharing agreement so that the forces and the militia underneath them can work to a common goal.
Wait, so the short version of that is that we need to rely on Iran to get us out of the ISIS mess in Iraq or the Iranian-backed forces?
No, the short answer is that we have to do an assessment to work out whether we need the populist mobilization forces in order to drive back ISIS. And if the answer is yes, then we need to do that. There's a big question here. I'll go back to the point I made at the beginning, which is about asymmetric warfare. The way that America beat the Soviets out of Afghanistan was utilizing the Mujahideen, who don't play by the rules. The way that they're trying to do it in Syria is by backing a certain number of Free Syrian Army or moderate rebels, which don't play by the rules. The way that the West fights these wars now is through proxy engagements. And that's the question that we have to raise when we're talking about working with the populist mobilization forces of the Peshmerga, who don't play by the same rules.
I don't know. I mean, Bob, what do you make of this? This sounds like sort of trying to pick the best horse in these places, and we have a real mixed record on that. We never know what monster we're creating by putting up some other part of these internal fights in the Middle East.
Well, that's exactly the point. These are monsters of our creation. I mean, you could say it was a wonderful strategy to back the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, the freedom fighters, as Ronald Reagan called them. And we felt with great certainty this would be in the interests of world peace and the interests of the Afghan people. And we were against a secular-backed government, by the way, that the Soviets backed. And it's been admitted by Gates and others who were involved at the time and have written about it that we actually used it as an excuse. And we were very deeply involved with the Mujahideen, these fanatics who ended up supporting and being Al-Qaeda before the Soviets invaded. So here we were on the side of the people we now feel are maniacs and that who attacked us. Then in the name of preventing that, we created a whole new bunches of maniacs. I mean, it is true Assad seems to be in a weakened position, but Josh, I don't think you could, or Rich, I don't think you could deny that we thought Assad was terrible, and we supported a coalition that included very dangerous fanatical people to overthrow him. And my only point was that Assad, Gaddafi, and Hussein were not on the side of these religious fanatics. On the other hand, Saudi Arabia, that we have backed and is our closest ally outside of Israel, has been on their side, has funded them, has supported them in all sorts of ways. So I think the policy really is an exercise in madness.
Rich, where do you think we need to go from here? Is it a matter of finding the right proxies?
Well, I think you don't quit on the Iraqi government yet, and you can't rely on the Kurds. You give more arms to the Kurds, they're either going to, and this is probably what they will do, is just fortify themselves in the borders of Kurdistan. Because if they really, and they realize this, if they really began, you know, sweeping into Mosul and taking back Sunni areas, you'd get a full-born sectarian warfare. So that's not very plausible. You have the same problem with Shia militias that aren't obviously trusted by the Sunni population, to say the least, given the horrific abuses that were visited on them by these militias, you know, over the last 10 years and continue to be so. So you have to try to back the Iraqi government and, you know, look at whether there needs to be more of an American element there, trainers, Ford air controllers, although I think there's the chances of the Obama administration going down that road or a route are very slim, and there's obviously not the political consensus for it in this country. But again, I just reject Bob's idea that there are only maniacs in the world because of the United States, and we back the Mujahideen, elements of which were okay, elements of which were quite radical extremists, because the Soviet Union, you know, this empire of slavery invaded Afghanistan and visited quasi-biblical levels of suffering on it. So in the real world as it actually exists, you oftentimes have to make difficult choices. And that was one of them that I think was correct, but are the Mujahideen perfect? No. And the idea that we created ISIS in Syria when we basically had a hands-off policy in Syria is also completely wrong. And in Syria, we get a little bit of a picture of what a Saddam Hussein-led Iraq might look like in a post-Arab Spring, post-Arab Revolution environment. And it'd probably look very much like Syria, where you have a murderous dictator who, yes, kills a lot of people and creates an enormous refugee crisis, but does not have the legitimacy or the ability to control his own territory and prevent it from being torn apart.
Mikey, I want to ask you about one of the actors that has failed to stabilize Syria, which is our major NATO ally in the region, Turkey. Reuters has a report out today about this video that purports to show the Turkish government sending arms to Islamist rebels inside Syria. I realize that, you know, Turkey and the Assad regime are enemies and they have an interest in undermining the Assad regime, but shouldn't Turkey also just have an interest in stability in the region? Why aren't they being more helpful in our effort to put ISIS down?
I don't think Turkey's interest is personally with Assad. I think Turkey's posturing against the PKK and the YPG, which they've been doing for over 20 years, that's been the huge issue. And I think the reason why we saw Turkey being a little bit laissez-faire about getting involved against ISIS is because ISIS was effectively going against their long arch enemy, which was the YPG, the Syrian Kurds. I think we have to look at what the biggest threat to America is. We have to have a good, hard conversation with ourselves, and we have to look at, you know, where the priorities lie. Kobani didn't fall because of the YPG. The YPG have been driving ISIS back out of northeastern Syria for a while. The Peshmerga in Iraq are also pretty ferocious when it comes to the fight. I think where I'm going with this is that the answer to, you know, any military activity is merely the extension of politics by a different means. That's a quote from Clausewitz. And I think that the answer to any of this is through a political roadmap that needs to be exercised before we start engaging in military activity. I do agree with Rich. I think the answer lies with conversation with the government of Iraq. I think it starts with Abadi. But when we talk about Iran, Josh, and we talk about, you know, the brutality of the populist mobilization forces over the last 10 years. Let's not be naive. The Shia population were oppressed under Saddam Hussein for many, many decades. And all you're seeing there is you're seeing a reaction to that play out because a security vacuum was created by the US and the UK and the West when they came in 2003. So I know we'll go on to this conversation about who's responsible a little bit later on, but the situation is incredibly complex. When we talk about ISIS, there will be no resolution to ISIS unless we have a look at Syria, until we really understand what the way forward forward is for Syria, and we look at who the competing elements are within Syria. That's where it is. Even if we kick ISIS back out of Ramadi and Anbar province, they're still going to go and hide in Raqqa and Aleppo, and they're still making progress in Deir ez-Zor. And then you've got the Hezbollah element, and then you've got Iran backing that. So, you know, we can't talk about Iraq without looking at Syria, I think is the sort of the core fundamental in this.
Let us know what you think about the persistence of ISIS at kcrw.com/LRC. Up ahead, Republicans blame each other for the rise of ISIS. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of the New York Times. Robert Scheer, author of the new book, They Know Everything About You, is on the left. Rich Lowry of National Review is on the right. And foreign correspondent Mikey Kaye is our special guest. So back in the United States, Republican primaries spent the week arguing over who's to blame for the rise of ISIS, and they've been pointing fingers at each other. MSNBC's Joe Scarborough asked Rand Paul how he feels about doves like him being blamed for the rise of ISIS, and Paul said the fault actually lies with Republican hawks who sent too many arms to the Middle East, which have fallen into the wrong hands. Then Bobby Jindal issued a statement in his official capacity as governor of Louisiana, saying Paul had taken, quote, the weakest, most liberal Democrat position on ISIS and was therefore unsuited to be commander in chief. The Wall Street Journal also ran an editorial with the headline, Rand Paul created ISIS, though they were sort of joking. Rich, who really did create ISIS? Was it Ben Carson's fault?
Oh, geez. Well, one, just on the sheer political front, I think we're a little bit back to 2008 where Ron Paul was a punching bag for the rest of the field in the debates, and we're not in any debates yet, but it feels as though Rand is serving that function. And I think these elements were already latent there in Iraq prior to our invasion. They were unleashed by the invasion, and importantly, the failure to establish order in the wake of the invasion until the surge in 2007, 8, 9, where you actually beat them back and decimated them and defeated them and had an Iraqi government that, for all its flaws, was in a pretty good place and was actually fighting the Shia militias in the south. And we, you know, you can argue counterfactuals all day long. So what I'm about to say is can be contested, and it's not provable. But I think we certainly adopted the highest risk course by pulling out entirely and losing our military and political influence. And Iraq has been spiraling downwards since then. And then you had the civil war in Syria. And when civil wars are allowed to burn hotter, people get more radicalized, and it gets more chaotic and brutal, and that's what we've seen in Syria. And the interaction of those two countries side by side has been the cauldron where ISIS has returned in force.
You know, Bob, it's interesting to me in that, you know, that this seems like a live fight, which is, I think, different from what Rich is describing about 2008. You can take either of these positions in the Republican primary, it feels like, and at least not be laughed off the stage. Now, obviously, Rand Paul's taking a lot of heat over this, but it the position doesn't feel as fringy as it did a few years ago.
Well, it also happens to be closer to the true assessment of what's going on than the so-called non-fringe candidates. I mean, it's interesting to hear this. Like, we really know what we're talking about, and we back people and know what they're talking about. But if you just shoot back when the first President Bush was there and Donald Rumsfeld was shaking hands with Saddam Hussein and said, we have to defeat Iran and we're with Iraq here. We certainly had close ties with Assad's father in Syria. We were getting cozy with Gaddafi in Libya under both Republicans and Democrats and saying, well, in an imperfect world, at least these people are not fanatics of the kind that the Saudi government seems to support. And you know, just as we are in the air now, today the U.S. said, oh, we no longer think Cuba is a terrorist state. We're going to have very normal relations. We have normal relations with Vietnam, despite losing that war, the most ignominious defeat the U.S. has ever had, but we seem to get along quite well. So this whole assumption that our military power is the agency of sanity and stability in the world is nonsense. The fact is, we make it worse. And you may not like that depiction. You may not like the idea we're squandering lives and money, but the objective reality is there. And let me ask you something about this security state that we've been asked to back, you know, including torture and eavesdropping. How come we didn't know about ISIS? How come our big experts didn't know about it? Where did it come from? How did it replace Al-Qaeda? You know, what is this strategy we have where we're supposedly this war? We don't even know who the players are. And finally, what is the role of Saudi Arabia in all this? After all, they're the ones that are really upset with Iran. They're the ones that are stoking a civil war in the religion, a religious fratricide. Why are we being led around by them? Why are we following their lead in Yemen? And so it seems to me when you don't have adults watching the story and you don't have people who really have a grasp on it, you should at least withdraw and take a lower profile position. And that's Rand Paul's view. Don't meddle unless you know what you're doing and you have support, or you're going to get burned. And he's going to be proved right on this.
You know, Mikey, it's interesting in what Bob said there about how the West was basically taken by surprise by the rise of ISIS, that we're having basically a counterfactual conversation here about what Iraq would be like if we had never invaded it and what Iraq would be like if we had not pulled out of it. It seems similar to the conversation we were having a couple of weeks ago with Jeb Bush, where he was saying, you know, I don't know whether I would have invaded Iraq knowing what I know now. It seems here we're trying to talk about, you know, well, we should have done X or we should have done Y because it would have resulted in a better non-ISIS outcome. But how can we know what would have happened in those alternate realities when we couldn't even predict what happened in this actual reality?
Well, the easy answer is that it's almost impossible to predict, Josh. But I mean, look, I'm a Brit. I've been living in the U.S. for 3 years now. So my analysis comes from a pretty impartial place. I sort of go on facts and what people say. And if what they say is ridiculous, I'll say it's ridiculous. And what they say is clever and articulate and well thought out, then I'll say that as well. I don't really care what flavor they are. What I would say is I went into North Lebanon, into Tripoli, in October 2013. And I met with a man called Omar Bakri, who's a radical sheikh that was deported from the U.K. He basically spilled the beans on everything that was going on with ISIS in terms of chemical weapons, in terms of what their plan was. And then about 6 months later, Clapper, who's the intelligence chap in the US, came out and said that they completely underestimated the power of ISIS. So the information has been there. If I can get into North Lebanon and talk with a radical cleric, then I'm sure the CIA and the intelligence agencies, you know, could have worked out what was going on a little bit earlier. Here's my approach on this, Josh. Prevention is better than cure. Okay, Rich was talking about the surge and sort of the secondary and tertiary consequences of actions. But prevention is better than cure. And accountability lies at a number of levels in government, starting with the executive branch. G.W. Bush and Dick Cheney completely and woefully underestimated what would happen if you take a dictator who opposed al-Qaeda and was the biggest countercheck to Iranian dominance, or the intent of Iranian dominance in the region. That was the first mistake. Accountability also lies at the legislative level, where 296 lawmakers in the House voted for the Iraqi resolution and 77 voted for it in the Senate. Then at the diplomatic level, you have Paul Bremer, who's the head of the occupation authority. And what he does when he wanders into Baghdad in his cowboy boots is the first thing he does is that he makes 400,000 Iraqi soldiers and officers unemployed. Some of that contingent are very high-ranking officers that work in the intelligence agencies. When you ask who created ISIS, the answer to that question is Haji Baka, who was an Iraqi colonel who worked in the intelligence agency. And the reason that he came up with the idea of ISIS was to oppose what was going on in his country post-Saddam Hussein. How those ideas grew was through Camp Bucca and Abu Ghraib, which is where Haji Baka, it's where al-Baghdadi, and it's where Sakari all met each other and came up with this great grandeur idea of ISIS. Rich is absolutely right. ISIS could grow because of what was going going on in Syria, and that was always the plan, was to go and hatch the plan from Iraq into Syria using Iraqi and foreign fighters, not Syrians, incidentally. There's a great report that came out in Der Spiegel about a month and a half ago, which kind of outlines all of this. I think then, you know, going back to Paul Bremer, you've got this idea that you can walk into a country, you can create a power vacuum, you can basically take out the Iraqi army and the police force, and then you can come up with this idea that you want to write an Iraqi constitution without having the people of Iraq mm-hmm. vote for a new government. And the Ayatollah Sistani, who's the head of the Shia in Iraq, completely opposed that view, and that's where the friction started to come. A year later, you then see what happened in Abu Ghraib, and that then cemented Sunni and Shia, who completely opposed then any occupation by any Western forces, and the whole thing just blew up. So again, yeah. There's a number of checks and balances that all went wrong, that weren't well thought out, and it all starts at the executive branch.
Let us know what you think about Rand Paul creating ISIS at kcrw.com/LRC. We've reached that timing once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Bob Scheer, your soapbox.
Yeah, I just want to ask people to have some caution about foreign policy and some humility. And the fact is, we have gotten it wrong almost all of the times, and our intelligence agencies have made a terrible mess. And I guess a name that didn't come up, where's Hillary Clinton in this? Didn't she want to get more involved in Syria? And isn't Rand Paul, in fact, being more reasonable on this question? Is Hillary really going to be able to invoke the lesser evil argument if you have a more reasonable Republican?
Rich Lowry, what's your rant?
NGOs tend to have a terrible bias against Israel, so I want to salute Amnesty International, which has issued a report pointing out how Hamas, which has some friends here in the United States, used last year's war with Israel to conduct abductions, torture, and extrajudicial executions. For Hamas, justice often involves a hood on your head and an AK-47 pointed at your chest.
Mikey, what's on your mind?
I would like to have a sit down with Ban Ki-moon because I think the UN Security Council is absolutely paralyzed in the new contemporary warfare environment and landscape that we live in. The P5 seems paralyzed at every level to do pretty much anything, whether it be intervention, whether it be looking at Israel, Gaza, whether it be looking at Syria, whether it be looking at disaster relief and humanitarian assistance in Nepal. And that is because of the way that it's set up. It's a post-World War II construct with a permanent five and 10 non-permanent members. And you've got the UK, France, China, Russia and the US who all hold the levers of power. And because of what's going on in the Ukraine and because of sort of this new flaring of the Cold War, pretty much the chance of getting any unanimous decision on doing anything in the world of any good has kind of been bypassed by China and Russia because of history that goes back over 50 years. And so my pet peeve is something needs to change there, because they're the corridors of international legitimacy. There is a potential to do good, but at the moment we're living in a landscape which is 50 years old. We're not living in 21st century, the asymmetric landscape.
Well, we're having another Republican presidential primary campaign, and so we're seeing the return of yet another dead idea, the flat tax. There are five candidates in or expected to be in the Republican field who are backing or have in previous campaigns backed a flat tax. The conceit behind the flat tax is that it's simpler, but what makes our tax code so complicated isn't having lots of rates. Rates are easy. You just read how much tax you owe off a tax table. The key effect of a flat tax is to cut taxes on the rich and then do one of two things. Either you can have drastically less revenue to the federal government, or you can have a tax increase on the middle class to offset the tax cut you've given the rich by cutting their rate from about 40 to in the high teens. And Republicans tend to gloss over that distinction, although they won't be able to do that in a general election. Mainstream candidates like Jeb Bush are taking a smarter approach, saying they want to cut rates and get rid of deductions. That's fine up to a point, but they need to avoid the trap Mitt Romney stepped in, which is that if you promise too much of a rate reduction, you won't be able to pay for it through expanding the tax base unless you start getting rid of lots of deductions for the middle class that are actually fairly well justified. So we'll see how that plays out, but in the past, this has been an issue that Republicans haven't been able to hack very well. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Robert Scheer, Rich Lowry, and Mikey Kay. Laura Dine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Sarah Singer Schiff is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Pajamas.
I'll wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
For we know we need each other, so we better call the calling of all. Let's call the whole thing off. Let's call it.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes, and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.